Okay, over to you, Francis.
All right. Hello, friends. Welcome to this 78th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars and Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view up here. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com up here in the upper left-hand corner. All right, just a few of us today. This month, in old diary leaves, Colonel Olcott inspects a pair of carved doors that were to provide entrance to the library of the Theosophical Society at Adyar. One of the local artisans chose to carve some doors for him. We can see them here in the background. They had avatars carved in them. And then you see Colonel Olcott here in the foreground, hanging out, reading. So can we get a reader? This is a shorty this week, this month.
I'll start this one off. The grand carved doors of the Adyar Library, on which are represented the 10 avataras of Vishnu, were the gift of Harishinji, and at Baunagar were awaiting my inspection before shipment. Imagine my surprise on finding that each avatara panel was flanked by tiny medallions in which were carved emblems which the native artisan thought would be most acceptable to the European taste. There they were, a silent sermon for our edification. On one, pistol. On another, a corkscrew. On a third, a soda water bottle. On a fourth, padlock, etc. And the innocent carver could not understand in the least the expression of horror that came into my face when I saw these artistic monstrosities. His own look of blank astonishment was too much for my gravity, and I exploded in laughter, giving him no doubt a suspicion that I was not altogether sane. Doors were not shipped until the offensive symbols had been cut out and replaced with lotus buds as they now stand.
Thank you, and that's it. Just one page today. Okay. So, last time, which has been a couple of months, I believe, because our last month was in the middle of the Waysock Festival, so we had to skip it. So we're going back to March, I guess, was our last webinar series. So last time we finished our study of the Gnostic creation story involving Pharaoh, Manu, and Abitur, the three logoi, and Fedahil, an emanation from the third logos, Abitur, commissioned to form the lower worlds, which he was unable to do without the help of a cast of lesser characters. I won't go back into the whole story now, but if you're interested, you can go back to the previous webinar. It's a pretty esoteric system that the Gnostics have, which is why, of course, HPB uses it to illustrate precursors to theosophy, you could say. We then took a look at Zoroastrianism, whose dualism, like the higher and lower eons of Gnosticism, was to be a harbinger for the, quote, dogmatic and dualistic religions of the future, a germ which has grown into such a luxuriant tree in the ecclesiastical Christianity. So her point she's making here is that at this level, notice You have the dualities, but there's no prejudice against them. They're just the yin and the yang. Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu, right? You could look at them almost like, you know, personification of the yin yang symbol, right? But by the time it had gotten to the, you know, the Gnostics also have the upper and the lower, right, which are deeply interconnected. But by the time you get to Christianity, then you get this extreme division of Christ and the devil, or God and the devil. After reading about Eliphas Levi and the Western Christian Kabbalists, HPB describes the astral light as the lower region of the anima mundi, or soul of the world, distinguishing it from the living fire of spirit. She goes on to say that the astral light is the, quote, life principle of every living creature, and furnishes the astral soul, the fluidic perispirit, to men, animals, fowls of the air, and everything living. The astral soul, or astral personal ego, in HPB theosophy is kama manasic, as shown here. You could see these qualities of ego are not the decay ego, but you have astral personal ego, elementary ego, and elemental ego in first generation theosophy. Perispirit means that which surmounts or embodies spirit. We then studied the Kabbalistic faces, the highest of which are called the Regimen Ignis, or Government of Fire, as shown here, and related their position to the Atma, Buddhi, Manas levels of modern theosophy. HPB then compares the Kabbalistic Sephira to the Tetractus, whose numbers 1, 3, 4, and 10 relate the two systems. Next, we take a look at the seven creative hierarchies, which HPB describes as, quote, the passive down to the active, the last of these beings being as near to the ahamkara element, the region or plane wherein egoship, or the feeling of I am-ness, is just beginning to be defined, as the first ones are near to the undifferentiated essence. The former are arupa, incorporeal, the latter rupa, corporeal. So the arupa are these higher levels. And then you have these lower rupa elemental hierarchies that form the bodies of those in between. We then consider the true nature of Jehovah, or Ilde Baot. That's another Gnostic form. Who we learn is, quote, simply one of the Elohim, the seven creative spirits, and one of the lower Sephiroth. HPB tells us that the highest female aspect is Sophia, the divine wisdom, which she identifies with Akasha, whereas the mother of Ilde Baoth was Sophia Akamoth, who personified the lower astral light, both of which are emanations from Bina, the third or feminine Sephiroth. So this is a good teaching that compared the two systems, the Gnostic and the Tree of Life. We then took a look at a relational comparison of the spiritual and psychic, and that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. In the next part of the footnote on page 197, we left off right here, HPB says, see, for the difference between nous, the higher divine wisdom and psyche, the lower and terrestrial, St. James 3, verses 15 through 17, vide demon est Deus inversus, part two of this volume. So there's a lot in this little sentence that she gives here. First, let's take a look at the verses from James. Then we'll get into the meaning of these verses and of the meaning of demon est Deus inversus. Can we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. James 3:15 to 17. 15. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. 16. From where envy and self-seeking exists, confusion and every evil thing are there. 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy.
Thank you, and Veronica. So here, HPP relates the terrestrial wisdom of psyche to James 3:15 and 16, right, where it says the wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual and demonic, etc. And the divine wisdom of nous, the highest aspect of the Greek soul, to James 3:17, with this lovely description. The meaning of the term demon est Deus inversus is summed up earlier in this volume. We'll read a couple of passages on this. It's an important idea. So could we get a reader first for this?
Sure. Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
They will see then that the word darkness does not apply to man's spiritual eyesight, but indeed to darkness, the absolute, that comprehendeth not, cannot cognize, transient light, however transcendent to human eyes. Demon is Deus inversus. The devil is now called darkness by the church, whereas in the Bible he is called the Son of God, see Job. The bright star of the early morning, Lucifer, see Isaiah.
Thank you. So let's take a look at the first paragraph of the chapter that appears later in this volume, which HPV references here, part two of this volume, which
you
is,
have it.
Yeah, I see that, which is called okay. Demon Est Inversus, the name of this chapter. Go ahead.
I can wait. I'll wait until you finish, and then I'll ask my question, please.
You mean you want to finish this section and then ask your question?
No, I had a question about the previous page in Lucifer, but it's a long question. So just finish your thought. It's fine, Francis, and then we'll come back to my question.
Well, actually, this reading may inform your my answer to your question as well as your question. So let's go ahead and read this, and then we'll take up your question. Okay? Can we get a reader, please?
Sure. Ariane, you want to read that, please?
On my screen, so I can't see it again. Let me just see if it reappears. I'm so sorry. I don't want to take your time, but I don't.
Are you having trouble pulling it up? Let's get someone else.
Okay. All right. Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
Demon est Deus inversus. This symbolical sentence, in its many-sided forms, is certainly most dangerous and iconoclastic in the face of all the dualistic later religions, or rather theologies, and especially so in the light of Christianity. Yet it is neither just nor correct to say that it is Christianity which has conceived and brought forth Satan. As an adversary, the opposing power required by the equilibrium and harmony of things in nature, like shadow to throw off still brighter the light, like night to bring into greater relief the day, and like cold to make one appreciate the more the comfort of heat. Satan has ever existed. Homogeneity is one and indivisible, but if the homogeneous, one and absolute, is no mere figure of speech, and if heterogeneity in its dualistic aspect is its offspring, its bifocus shadow or reflection, then even that divine homogeneity must contain in itself the essence of both good and evil. If God is absolute, infinite, and the universal root of all and everything in nature and its universe, whence comes evil or devil, if not from the same golden womb of the absolute? Thus we are forced either to accept the emanation of good and evil, or agathodaimon and kakodaimon, as offshoots from the same trunk of the tree of being, or to resign ourselves to the absurdity of believing in two eternal absolutes.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, your question?
Okay, Aria. That was an extraordinary passage, so well read. Thank you, Vivian. So we consider duality as a descending octave. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that spirit takes on matter. And I just wonder what you could say about Lucifer. Maybe I should just wait for the reading today. But he just referred to Job, you know, and whatever you can do to shed light on that.
Well, we talked some about Lucifer in other webinars, but it is the same concept. You have, you know, this idea of the reversal of Satan, who is an arupic being of a very high order. In fact, I mean, just think about how close Satan is to Sanat. I mean, all you have to do is shift two letters, right? And so you have that absolute reversal of that high order of Satan in the Christian religion. Well, the exact same thing happened with Lucifer. We're going to be getting into it a little more here, who was considered a fallen angel, which is correct, but the connotation of fallen is misunderstood. Fallen, I could think of other applications of this too, you know, like the way that Venus falls in Virgo. It falls because it literally goes into form. So the same thing with Lucifer. That great being came into the manifested realms, quote unquote, fell in order to give light to mankind. It's the exact same myth with Prometheus. And there's other stories about this quality of light giving to the lesser, but from the higher. But the church in their, for whatever reasons, in both the cases of Satan and Lucifer, chose to literally demonize them, you know, making them really the same being, this, you know, as the minions of hell and the the lord of that lower darkness. It's a complete fabrication by the church, as we can see. You know, again, I just point out, you know, that slide with Ahura Mazda here, you know, somewhere back here. Oh boy, it's way back. Too far back.
Yeah. Well, you know, it sounds like it's part. Can you hear me?
Yeah, here it is. Yeah. So you have, yeah, you see, there's no prejudice in this image. Notice they even hold two sides of the same ring. This was the ancients' understanding of duality, you know. And yes, Angra Mianyu represented the material aspect, but they were both, they also recognized that they were both from the divine. And that's what changed. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm so sorry I can't see the image and speak at the same time, but just to say that the church, it maybe it's part of this Jewish dispensation again, that like there's some kind of confusion about the role of matter and in the East, that if one could bring in the witness like Sanat Kumara, that the role of God is not only the creator, but it's the witness, that it brings light, that it illuminates all forms, then we're not, you know, we can experience the world in its materiality, because this is a very material planet. And part of our spiritual growth means confronting and wrestling with that aspect of ourselves, right? It's not about just, you know, in New Age groups, when they call that a spiritual bypass, you know, that we say that is beneath us. I am not. And so the church uses that fear, you know, the fear that one would really be caught up in that, without giving any tutelage about how one could actually overcome that, you know, duality. It makes it into a concrete form. And this is, you know, when I mentioned before that, you know, the Sanat Kumara article wasn't taken down in its entirety on Wikipedia, that we don't even know the names of the gods related to our planet, that we don't know the role of Venus, we don't know what this planet is about, or the plan, or how humanity has a role. And this seems like now is the time, in order to save the planet, that we have to exercise and spread that knowledge. It's of utmost importance that we cannot just become an activist, for instance. That is not enough. We have to work on ourselves. But it's not enough to work on ourselves either, just to pursue our own evolution, because then we're not in right relationship to the world or this time.
Yeah, you could even make the point that, you know, this escapism that's built into, you know, avoiding hell by being a good Christian, and therefore having all your ideas about spirituality be, you know, being good, making a contract with Jesus, that kind of thing, is that all of that is ultimately responsible for the demise of our planet, you know, because it was never considered to be a sacred thing. Not just by Christians, of course, and Jewish, because it's a planet-wide, and it's not the only influence that has contributed to this. But, you know, if the mother is not revered, you know, she will die if she's not sustained, you know, or, you know, more accurately, humanity will die and the mother will recover over the millions of years that follow. So, I think the effects of this Christian point of view, which is absolutely 180 degrees opposite of the theosophical understanding, I have been more damaging than people realize, you know, that it really has conditioned the thinking in modern society.
Yeah, I just want to respond briefly to that too, if I could. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and I think that where the trap is there is that, you know, people think that being a good person is the goal, right? That if one is good, that is sufficient, being nice, being virtuous. Mm-hmm. And to be such things, one also has to be aware moment to moment and understand the law of harmlessness and karma. One cannot be good if one doesn't know oneself. There's no way. We don't have the restraint or the self-understanding to know who we are. And it just seems, it's really pathetic. And so I just say that because it's a warning to all of us, I think, especially in America, about the focus on that, as if that were enough.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you 100%. If your righteousness, your, you know, being good, as you call it, it is not rooted in self-awareness, it's a kind of parroting of a doctrine that you're not actually able to understand, and it won't stick. You will eventually become who you are and act like who you are. You can't fake it forever, you know. So the self-awareness has to come first, you know, and then the right action, right thought, etc., follows, you know, progressive stages of self-awareness. Thank you, Ariane. As usual, it's you have great contributions. Appreciate it. Anyone else?
Francis, yes. Anne Veronica, she says, okay, I'm sorry, Anne Veronica, my Greek sucks. Agayo demon is the good demon, the beneficial. Kako demon is the evil demon, and Plato used to call the soul a demonio.
Right, good. Thank you for that. She describes it here, emanations of good and evil, of agato demon and kako demon, as office, you know. I mean, the point she makes here is so important, which is that if God is all, you know, if God is the absolute universal root, then it must contain within itself both the agato daemon and the kako daemon. That is to say, the material and the spiritual. After all, that's the whole point of manifestation, is for the kako daemon to eventually come into awareness of its own higher nature and transcend the materialistic stage, right? Okay. All right, next up, can we get a reader?
Yes. Michelle, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. He produces from himself seven other gods, stellar spirits, or the lunar ancestors, for they are all the same. They are all in his own image, the spirits of the face, and the reflection one of the other, and have become darker and more material as they successfully receded from their originator. They also inhabit seven regions disposed like a ladder, as its rungs slope up and down the scale of spirit and matter. With pagans and Christians, with Hindus and Chaldeans, with the Greek as with the Roman Catholics, with a slight variation of the texts in their interpretations, they all are the genii of the seven planets. As of the seven planetary spheres of our septenary chain, of which Earth is the lowest. See Isis, volume 2, page 186. This connects the stellar and lunar spirits with the higher planetary angels and the Isis.
Rishis.
The seven Rishis of the stars, of the Hindus, as subordinate angels, messengers to the Rishis, the emanations on the descending scale of the former.
Thank you. Okay, first, he, Jehovah, produces from himself seven other quote-unquote gods, stellar spirits, or the lunar ancestors, for they are all the same. So this chart shows the region of the Gnostic Pleroma that Jehovah, who is Yaldabaoth, and his seven emanations inhabit. The Gnostics believe that the stellar spirits have a negative influence on human destiny and tried to escape their control by acquiring gnosis, hence the word Gnostics, or knowledge of God. They also practiced baptism, anointing, and Eucharist, which is the consecration of certain elements such as bread and wine, to purify themselves from the defilement of the material world, which the stellar spirits represent. So for the Gnostics, Yaldabaoth, who is Jehovah, was akin to the Christian Satan. Another example of demon est deus inversus. So you can see here, the lists of these, what are called archons, and their relationship to the lower aspects of these planets, you know, deceit, injustice, wrath, pride, lust, greed, inconstancy, right? And then you also have the elements themselves. So these are thought forms. They exist both at the level of thought and emotion, whereas this is the actual physical plane elements, called the Archons of the Abyss. Okay, we've looked at this more completely in past webinars, where we really got into the Gnostic system. Okay, the footnote referencing lunar ancestors states, Jehovah's connection with the moon in the Kabbalah is well known to the students. And of course, the moon represents the form aspect. So that's in keeping with this idea of the lower archons. This is the physical realm, the material planes of existence. And the footnote equating the stellar spirits with the lunar ancestors states about the Nazarenes, see Isis, volume 2, page 131 and 132, the true followers of the true Christos were all Nazarenes and Christians and were the opponents of the later Christians. Though not on pages cited in this footnote, we do have this germane quote. Before we get there, you can see this contrast between the earlier and later Christians, where you don't have this form of inversion of evil, of good and evil. Okay, could we get a reader for this footnote?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
In Isis Unveiled, several of the Gnostic systems are given. One is taken from the Codex Nazareus, the scriptures of the Nazarenes, who, although they existed long before the days of Christ and even before the laws of Moses, were Gnostics, and many of them initiates. They held their mysteries of life in Nazara, ancient and modern Nazareth, and their doctrines are a faithful echo of the teaching of the secret doctrine, some of which we are now endeavoring to explain.
Thank you. So, there were so many elements of Christianity or that were adopted by Christianity that pre-existed yet as a religion. Christianity tended to choose elements of the ancient wisdom and the mysteries that suited it in order to create the later version of Christianity, which is very distinct from the Gnostic Christian belief system. Okay. Next up, they are, let's see here, make sure I'm on the right page here. They are all in his, Jehovah's own image, the spirits of the face, and the reflections one of the other, and have become darker and more material as they successively receded from their originator. They also inhabit seven regions disposed like a ladder as its rungs slope up and down the scale of spirit and matter. So the spirits of the face are actually seven spirits of the one face, which is Yaldabaoth, the true Jehovah's Witnesses, by the way. So, you know, you could see these as the true Jehovah's Witnesses because they are witnessing the effects of this actual Jehovah. They are also called the thrones, the Hebdomad, and the seven powers. Each has a quote-unquote face that reflects one of the aspects of the Yaldabaoth, such as fire, water, darkness, light, etc. And they are also usually associated with the seven planets, as shown here. But in Gnostic thought, they represent the negative influence of the planets, not the planets as divine archetypes. The successive regions or rungs inhabited by the spirits of the face is depicted as concentric circles in many old charts, such as this one from circa 1000 AD, and this one from the Middle Ages, which we've used before. The footnote referenced by the phrase, as its rungs slope up and down the scale of spirit and matter, states, Vita Supra, the diagram of the lunar ring of seven worlds, where, as in our or any other chain, the upper worlds are spiritual, while the lowest, whether moon, earth, or any planet, is dark with matter. Vita Supra means, as described earlier in the text, by lunar ring, HPB means the sublunary group of seven planets in progressive states or stages of tenuity, such as those found in a chain of the Earth scheme. Next, and we're going to be talking about this idea a bit more. Next, with pagans and Christians, with Hindus and Chaldeans, with the Greek as with the Roman Catholics, with a slight variation of the text and their interpretations, they all were the genii of the seven planets, as of the seven planetary spheres of our septenary chain, of which Earth is the lowest, see Isis. So first we have to understand what HPB means by the term genie. In first generation theosophy, solar genii or genii, also called agathodaimons, are considered to be the source of life and light, whereas the lunar genii, called the kakodaimons, are what is being described in this teaching on the Gnostics. Interestingly, HPB also relates this graded septenet to the globes of a chain, which are named after the seven planets. You can see them. Any thoughts or questions about this? Finally, this connects the stellar and lunar spirits with the higher planetary angels and the Saptarishis, the seven rishis of the stars of the Hindus, as subordinate angels, messengers, to these rishis, the emanations on the descending scale of the former. It's a confusing sentence. So HPB here draws a connection between three groups, the stellar, also called the lunar spirits, the higher planetary angels, and three, the Sapta rishis, or seven rishis of the stars, suggesting that, and here's the explanation, the lunar spirits are emanations of the planetary angels, right? The elementals of the higher planetary agathodaimon. and that these higher planetary angels are themselves messengers from the still higher seven rishis, the Sapta rishis. This is borne out in DK's description of the relation between the seven stars of the Great Bear and the seven sacred planets. What DK doesn't focus on so much is the lower emanation, the stellars, the lunar petries, which he calls planetary elementals. Any thoughts or questions? Okay. Next up, could we get a reader, please?
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Such in the opinion of the philosophical Gnostics were the God and the archangels now worshipped by the Christians. The fallen angels and the legend of the war in heaven is thus purely pagan in its origin and comes from India versus via Persia and Chaldea. The only reference to it in the Christian canon is found in Revelations 7, as quoted a few pages back. Thus, Satan, once he ceases to be viewed in the superstitious, dogmatic, unphilosophical spirit of the churches, grows into grandiose image of one who made a terrestrial, a divine man, who gave him throughout the long cycle of Madhyakalpa the law of spirit of life and made him free from the sin of ignorance, hence of death.
Okay, thank you. First, such in the opinion of the philosophical Gnostics were the God and the archangels now worshipped by the Christians. HPP here points out that Jehovah, the given name of the Christian God, and the seven archons that sprung from him are all lunar gods created by the lower version, the astral light version of Sophia, called Sophia Achamoth. Next, the fallen angels and the legend of the war in heaven is thus purely pagan in its origin and comes from India via Persia and Chaldea. Pagan meaning non-Christian origins that far predated the Christian version of the story. But whatever the origin, at the esoteric root of all teachings on the war in heaven, we have those devas who were compelled to carry out the involutionary law that drives spirit into matter at the beginning of each cycle, versus the higher, arupa, or formless class of deva, who resisted this law in order to build the higher vehicles for humanity. Next, the only reference to it in the Christian canon is found in Revelations 12, as quoted a few pages back. Okay, here's the verse from Revelations, which is quoted on page 194. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. As mentioned before, this verse, which is a 180-degree reversal of the true teaching, was promulgated by the church fathers for reasons best known to themselves. I mean, why choose to exalt a lesser lunar creator god to the status of the one and only God? Did they not know any better, or was it a purposeful act of deception? At any rate, the paragraph we've been studying, taken as a whole, not only reveals that the Christian God and his archangels to be lunar petries, but also infers that the Asuras, which the Christians revile, are in fact great solar beings who are much more evolved than the Christian Jehovah, ironically. Talk about demon est deus inversus. One can't help but consider the idea that the impetus for this corruption of church doctrine came from the Dark Brotherhood. This paragraph sets up the extraordinary passage that follows, quote, "Thus Satan, once he ceases to be viewed in the superstitious, dogmatic, unphilosophical spirit of the churches, grows into the grandiose image of one who made of terrestrial a divine man." Satan, again according to HBB, is the chief asura, and therefore a very highly evolved being. As before mentioned, in fact, Lord of the Asuras. As before mentioned, he and the other Asuras who refused to incarnate instead built the higher vehicles for humanity. I'm sure it took all of HBB's first-rate courage to put this teaching forward and then to hold fast in the face of the inevitable public outrage. I mean, it takes real strength of character to put out a magazine entitled Lucifer, right? And finally, who gave him throughout the long cycle of Mahakalpa the law of the spirit of life and made him free from the sin of ignorance, hence of death. See the section on Satan in part 2, volume 2. So Satan offered Eve fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the eating of which bestowed on her the ability to discriminate between good and evil. You may remember that DK describes a threefold Virgo, with Eve representing the mental plane, Isis the astral, and Mary the physical plane of the divine feminine. Thus, Satan opened the door of mind to Eve, who represents the intelligence aspect of the divine feminine in all humankind. Here's the section on Satan in part 2 of Secret Doctrine 2, cited here, entitled, "Is Pleroma," referring to the Gnostic heaven, "Satan's lair?" And here's a passage from near the beginning of this section. It's quite a long section, so we can't look at the whole thing, but this gives us a good taste of what is in that section. Could we get a reader, please?
Okay, first, Ariane has her hand up.
Go ahead.
Oh my God, this is so breathtaking. This is extraordinary. So anyway, so what they're saying here, and I know there was the Lucis Trust and there's the Lucifer magazine, and you know, in a way it's like talking about the power of God, right? The power aspect that could destroy one. But it seems like Satan is like someone who's fully alive, right? That is alive to every aspect, to the beingness, the livingness of a human possibility. And so a dragon is something that comes, you know, in China from the image of a dinosaur, you know, one of the most primitive, you know, beings. And even if it were spiritual, there's some kind of unconscious understanding of what the dragon is, you know, that it could be both something that could be transformed, but also that it has like this kind of root where it's, you know, related to avarice and unsatiability and things like that. So it just seems like those two images have been merged, like the dragon and Satan. And like you're saying right now, they have to be disentangled for us to really understand how we might evolve individually in this room, the people here.
Yeah, good thoughts, Ariane. There's two serpents, right? The Master DK talks about the dragons of wisdom. You know, even a master of wisdom is called a dragon of wisdom. And then you have the divine dragon of wisdom, who is the solar logos, right? Lesser dragons of wisdom are the planetary logos. So the term dragon has a And also this idea that comes from Capricorn, connected with a crocodile, is also has its source in the dragon, the Makara, you know, which is the surname of the rulers of this planet, is very much connected with the dragon. Then on the other end, you have, for instance, in Egyptian mythology, you have Apep, A-P-E-P, which represents what we think of as the lower dragon, you know, all the temptations, et cetera, trying to pull you down. But they very much definitely recognize the higher dragon, and it's much more powerful. Let's go ahead and read this. I think we'll get even more understanding from this. Reader, please.
Ben, can you read that for us, please? I don't see him unmuting. Ben? Okay. Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
I can.
Ben, I think. Oh, no. Never mind.
Sorry, Francis. The old dragon and Satan now become singly and collectively the symbol of, and the theological term for, the fallen angel. It's not so described either in the original Kabbalah or the Chaldean Book of Numbers, or in the modern. For the most learned, if not the greatest, of modern Kabbalists, namely
Eliphas Levi.
Thank you. Eliphas Levi describes Satan in the following glowing terms. Quote, it is that angel who is proud enough to believe himself God, brave enough to buy his independence at the price of eternal suffering and torture, beautiful enough to have adored himself in full divine light, strong enough to reign in darkness amidst agony, and to have built himself a throne on his inextinguishable pyre. Yes, indeed, it is this grandest of ideals, this ever-living symbol, nay, apotheosis of self-sacrifice for the intellectual independence of humanity, this ever-active energy protesting against static inertia, the principle to which self-assertion is a crime, and thought and the light of knowledge odious, end quote. It is, as Eliphas says, with unparalleled justice and irony, quote, this pretended hero of tenebrous eternities, who slanderously charged with ugliness, is decorated with horns and claws, which would fit far better his implacable tormentor. It is he who has been finally transformed into a serpent, the red dragon, end quote.
Which William Blake painted, the red dragon. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, this is Sophia, the divine Sophia, looking up at this red dragon. There's no indication in the painting, except for that it is a dragon, of what William Blake, what his philosophy was on this. I would guess that it was somewhat enlightened on this. So the, you know, Eliphas Levi can be dense, but if you take the time to tear apart what he says, it's often quite illuminating. But just this last part I thought was especially good. So yes, indeed, it is this grandest of ideals, this ever-living symbol, nay, apotheosis of self-sacrifice for the intellectual independence of humanity. Self-sacrifice for the intellectual independence of humanity. Think in terms of, you know, Eve receiving the fruit of the tree of good and evil, right? Tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So that's this, you know, sacrificial act. It's also Prometheus giving light to humanity, which is always opposed by the status quo, this method, right? That's another story, why that's true, has to do with the normal unfolding of nature rather than this quickened method where light is given. So then he goes on to describe Satan here, this ever active energy protesting against static inertia. I think that really sums it up, providing intellectual independence to humanity, which, just that fact, is the ever active energy protesting against static inertia, the principle to which self assertion is a crime, and thought and the light of knowledge odious. So the opposition to this, which is the Christian opposition, sees self-assertion as a crime. You're to conform to the church values, and thought and the light of knowledge odious for the same reasons. So it's a beautiful quote. And we will hit it again in some many years in the future, if we ever get there, on Second Volume Secret Doctrine. Okay, and with that, we finish HVB's commentary on verse 5 of stanza 6. Before we move on to verse 6, I'd like to take a look at MPH's commentary on verse 5. If while reading this passage it seems familiar, it's because we took a look at this passage out of sequence a couple of webinars ago, actually many webinars ago now, due to an error in HBB's numbering of the verses. I really puzzled over this trying to put it together, but she misnumbered the verse, and therefore this was introduced earlier in the stream of things. No big deal, no harm done. So let's go ahead and read this passage on the right.
Fred, can you read? Yeah, Fred, can you read that for us, please? Okay, I don't see him unmuting. Helio Soul, can you read that for us, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, great. The fourth round of every chain is that of greatest density. At that time, the sparks, individualized from the body of the Logos, must assume their fourth rate of consciousness. In the case of our chain of globes, the fourth round was the beginning of human life as we know it today. Some of the spiritual globes of light, which we call spirits, refused to come in, and upon them was pronounced a curse. The curse was the reaction of the law upon those who refused to obey it. They became the red men who were born in the fourth race, which we know as the Atlanteans, and were the most warlike and destructive of all nations.
Thank you. So as mentioned before, the red men here described are the half animal, half men earlier discussed, which the old commentary describes in volume 2. Could we get a reader, please?
Can you read that for us, please? Tom?
Me? Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay. There were blue and red-faced animal men even in later times, not from actual intercourse between the human and animal species, but by descent. And still another passage mentions red-haired, swarthy men going on all fours, who bend and unbend, stand erect and fall on their hands again, who speak as their forefathers and run on their hands as their giant foremothers.
Thank you, Tom. The curse that was pronounced on the quote, spirits who refused to come in, refers to the Manasaputras, who refused, or soul aspect, who refused to overshadow the early third root race, and thus became karmically responsible for the anthropoids that result from this cross-breeding. So, yeah, that does it for verse 5. And now we'll move on to the next verse, which is repeated here. So could we get a reader for the verse? Yes, Anne Veronica, I see your hand up.
So they refused to come down, but they came down. And they became the red, what did we say then? The red men.
Let's see. No, you're talking about two different groups here. The ones that refused to come down were the overshadowing souls, and because they refused, the animal and human kingdoms mixed and created this half man, half animal. Okay. Does that make sense?
Okay, for the ones that descended.
The ones that descended weren't the red men. They were the soul aspect, the Manasaputras. You know, what they felt that the early third root race Lemurians weren't yet developed enough to become overshadowed. They wanted to wait until the form was better suited for their overshadowing. But they were developed enough to procreate with the animal kingdom, creating this subspecies of animal man. And so as a result, the Manasaputras became karmically liable for the fact that they hadn't overshadowed this early Lemurian race. Does that make sense?
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. You want to ask?
Okay, we have a couple more hands. Iliosol, you want to go ahead?
Thank you. Francis, can you please go over again, overshadowing souls? It's identification, because they have not incarnated where they were asked, or it's their status, and are they the same as Manasaputras, as you just mentioned, or not?
The overshadowing souls?
Yes.
Yeah, they're the same. Manasaputras, you know, are of solar descent, solar, and therefore they literally are solar angels who, you know, made this great sacrifice in the middle of the third root race to overshadow animal man. And through that overshadowing, those animal men entered the fourth kingdom in nature, right? Because the spark of mind was implanted. The metaphor for that is the Lucifer, the fallen angel Lucifer, who represents this group, and also Prometheus, you know, who gave fire to humankind. So those are the mythological metaphors for this great event that happened in the middle of the third root race.
So there was a positive event, after all, for the evolution of humanity, yes or no?
Oh, of course. Yeah, yes, that's yes. That's why we are where we are today. But there was this kind of glitch where man was developed enough because, see, in the early part of the third root race, the method of procreation was taken on. Before that, it was a more etheric method of projection.
Oh, okay.
And so as soon as that happened, then the great mistake of being able to procreate with the animal kingdom became possible, happened and there was a group that resulted, which we've talked about this in past webinars more extensively, but there was a whole process where they are being trained on the inner side and will re-enter and merge with the human kingdom at a certain point. And because, you know, after all, half of them was human or came from human. And so they had that divine right to eventually enter the human kingdom. And in fact, they will do that way, way, way before the next group of animals will enter the human kingdom.
So this is a vast story. And what is to read about that in depth? In your recommendation, besides that monumental work of Blavatsky, if to look at that specific story, because it's kind of really interesting to me. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Go back about three webinars and listen on YouTube.
Ah. Because
I would guess somewhere about then it's described and discussed in much greater detail.
Mm-hmm.
What you could do is pull up, you know, I'm sorry, I don't, you know, I haven't been able to, you know, create a table of contents for these webinars. That would be fantastic, you know, if somebody did that, so that we would know exactly what takes place in each of the webinars, but that hasn't happened yet. But what you can do is, you know, you could go three back and then skip through it a little bit and see if that content is being discussed. And if so, then, you know, start it over again. You just have to do a little trial and error, you know. I'm just sort of guessing with the three webinar mark, but I think it'd be something like that. I see a couple of hands.
Yes, Yvonne has had her hand up. Go ahead, Yvonne.
Okay. On this, it says some of the spiritual globes of light, which we call spirits, refused to come in, and upon them was the curse. So this was the solar angels, and they couldn't come in because of the density of what the animal man was just too dense, right? They weren't able to come in. So
I don't know, able or if a choice was made.
That's what I'm wondering. Refused to come in and upon them. What was the curse that was put on them?
Well, the curse is the fact that these, you know, the red men, the half animal, half men, came into being, and that became a karmic burden. It's an extraordinary teaching. You know, I wouldn't have thought that Manasa Putras were capable of carrying a karmic burden, nor capable of making such a mistake. But that's this old teaching. You know, you don't hear a whisper of this in DK. This is all first generation theosophy, and it's fascinating.
Are the Atlanteans?
No, well, yeah, they became the red men who were born in the fourth race, which we know as the Atlanteans.
Atlanteans were about three or four different colors, weren't they? Yellow ones and white ones and red ones.
Yeah, and evidently this group was a throwback. And, you know, he makes a point of saying that there was the earlier group, direct progenitors, and then there was this group that was born later. I don't know the connection between the two.
Yeti, the abominable, the snowman, you know, the Yeti. He doesn't come in here. Is this where he comes in?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any mention of Yeti and the secret doctrine. That'd be an interesting search criteria. I could do that and find out if Yeti comes in. But it would be that type of throwback, you know, that you'd be looking at.
An intelligent being that half works on its hands sometimes and upright sometimes and hairy and red. And
yeah, right.
Such the description they give.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, modern, certainly orangutans and apes, you know, fit that bill. But she makes a point at one point of saying that it's not the modern primates. That's not this group.
Thank you.
Yeah, so. Okay, anyone else? It is fascinating. Yes, go ahead.
Ariane, go ahead. You got your hand up. And then Fred after you.
Yeah, so is the two questions. The Cro-Magnon man who sort of comes in and dies out, is that what's referred to here? Because they say that there's no direct line. You know, it seems like there's like a interval between humanity and these primitive animal beings. I don't know if that's correct in my understanding. And
it's very difficult to relate modern scientific anthropology to the ageless wisdom, the main reason being that the time scales are so vastly different. Mm-hmm. So, these, for instance, Cro-Magnon and earlier Neanderthal, et cetera, are just million year plus old. You know, I don't know the exact dates. I think even less than that. Whereas Atlantis itself lasted for 10 million years, and we were individualized 21 million years ago. So clearly the archaeological record doesn't reflect the ageless wisdom. You know, I think there are all kinds of branch races, offshoots down through time, and that would account for the Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal offshoots. But you know, I'm the last one to try to explain away the disparities between the two systems, because they definitely exist. You know.
Yeah. Well, humanity doesn't recognize how old humanity is, like you said, 18 and a half million years. And, you know, Edgar Cayce talks about Atlantis being destroyed over time, like there were big series of destructions that it came into being and was destroyed maybe three times. But one of the things that he seems to make a point of saying is that there was this gross injustice. Benjamin Krem says the same thing, that there was this kind of bifurcation of who had power and who had not. And those people who had power had learned it from hierarchy, had learned it from the masters of wisdom. And so they were abusing that and enslaving and keeping oppressed huge swaths of humanity. But they were people of color that was happening to. So I just say that because it's very similar to what's happening now again.
Yeah, well, the end of the Atlantean race happened because of that great war between the followers of the Dark Face and of the Spirit of Light. And as a result, the plug had to be pulled, because the as a whole, the Atlantean brute race at that time, that sub-race, had not developed intellect, and so they were so impressionable by the dark forces that it would have set back that race even further if the Great Flood had not been introduced in order to stop the process, you know, because it was deteriorating, literally. The gains that had been made Atlantis lasted many millions of years, and so there were important gains made in the first four sub-races, you know, and then the Dark Face had its day of power, and so the plug had to be pulled. And yeah, the resurgence of that happened in World War II, but as DK says, that the door to evil has not yet been closed, and so we're still in this battle. No question. Anybody else? Fred, I think, had his hand up.
Yes. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. Since we're talking about Makara, I've always been curious. If we want to find past episodes of this webinar, we go to something called Makara. Why did they choose that name? The repository, I've always wanted to ask, and it always seemed out of place. So this is as close as a reason I could find. So,
oh, well, good. You asked in the right webinar, because what I can do is go back. Let's see, we're on slide number 73. And I just happened to, in my introduction, brought up a slide of the 12 hierarchies. And you'll see that the fifth hierarchy, called the human personality, but also it's the hierarchy of human soul. They're called the crocodiles, dragons, Makara, the mystery, seekers of satisfaction. So now you're looking at the personality aspect. But then you have the perfect ones, the fivefold links. So the Makara is another way of describing these dragons of wisdom who are associated with Capricorn. And this particular hierarchy, that is a dual hierarchy of personality and soul, is ruled by the Makaras, which, as I said, is the it's not really a surname, but it's one of the two names given to the seven Makaras who rule in Shambhala. Sanat Kumara being a Makara, right? So Kumara and Makara are also, you can see just in the word, they're so similar.
So why would that be chosen as the name for where we go to find past episodes of the webinar?
Because it represents wisdom.
Okay, good enough.
Makara.us, by the way. And yeah, it's a source of wisdom, you could say, Makara. Very much the third aspect. The Makaras are great dragons of the third principle, which is outer knowledge, which is what, of course, the website's all about. Good question, though.
So just out of curiosity of the history of this, did Michael give it the name, or do we have any idea who named it?
Yes, Michael.
Yeah, I would guess almost certainly it would have been. Yeah, you're welcome. It's an astonishing repository of material. I mean, you know, I've known about it, you know, for the last 10 years. I'm only recently discovering just how much stuff is there. It's really amazing. Okay, let's see, back to here. Anybody else? Was that it for questions?
That's it right at this moment.
Okay, so with this last description of the verse 5 from Manly P. Hall, we finish our HPB's commentary on verse 5. So next up, verse 6. Could we get a reader, please, for this?
I'll start it. And you just mean the top part there, right, in black?
Yeah. It's always the middle section. Yeah.
Yeah.
It repeats what's here.
Okay. The older wheels rotated downward and upward. The mother's spawn filled the whole cosmos. There were battles fought between the creators and the destroyers, and the battles fought for space. The seed appearing and reappearing continuously.
Okay. So this is what we'll be talking about all through this section on verse 6. Basically, HPB comments on the concepts that are brought up in these verses. That's what the secret doctrine is, you know, commentary on the thoughts, ideas put forth in these great verses. So let's continue with HPB's commentary that references the A section. See this little A here, which she then breaks out for her commentary. Could we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that, please?
Here, having finished for the time being with our side issues, which, however, they may break the flow of the narrative, are necessary for the elucidation of the whole scheme, the reader must return once more to cosmogony. Mogony, the phrase older wheels refers to the worlds of globes of our chain, as they were during the previous rounds. The present stanza, when explained esoterically, is found embodied entirely in the Kabbalistic works. Therein will be found the very history of the evolution of those countless globes which evolve after a periodic pralaya, rebuilt from old material into new forms.
Thank you, Yvonne. Okay, so first, here, having finished for the time being with our side issues, which, however they may break the flow of the narrative, are necessary for the elucidation of the whole scheme, the reader must return once more to cosmogony. So the phrase older wheels refers to the worlds of or globes of our chain, as they were during the previous rounds. So in spite of the fact that verse 5 is part of stanza 6, it seems that HPB considers the war in heaven and the adoption by both Jewish and Christian doctrine of daemon est deus in versus a side issue, perhaps because these subjects aren't directly involved in the chains, rounds, and globes of esoteric cosmology. Finally, the present stanza, when explained esoterically, is found embodied entirely in the Kabbalistic works. Therein will be found the very history of the evolution of those countless globes which evolve after periodical pralaya, rebuilt from old material into new forms. So HPB is probably referring to the Kabbalistic Sefer Yetzirah, a second century work, also called the Book of Formation, which describes the process of creation through the combination of the Hebrew letters and the Sephiroth, deeply veiled though, compared to what we're getting here, which came to be known as the Tree of Life. The other great Kabbalistic work from that period, or a little later actually, is the Zohar, which comments on the hidden meaning of certain biblical stories, laws, and symbols, as well as the nature of God as it relates to cosmic history. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that, please?
The previous globes disintegrate and reappear transformed and perfected for a new phase of life. In the Kabbalah, words are compared to sparks which fly from under the hammer of the great architect, law, the law which rules all the smaller creators. The following comparative diagram shows the identity between the two systems, the Kabbalistic and the Eastern. The three upper are the three higher planes of consciousness, revealed and explained in both schools only to the initiates. The lower ones represent the four lower planes, the lowest being our plane, or the visible universe. The seven planes correspond to the seven states of consciousness in man. It remains with him to attune the higher, It remains with him to attune the three higher states in himself to the three higher planes in cosmos. But before he can attempt to attune, he must awaken the three seats to life and activity. And how many are capable of bringing themselves to even a superficial comprehension of Atma Vidya, spirit knowledge, or what is called by the Sufis, Rohani?
Thank you, Vivian.
Okay, hold it. Okay. Vivian, please Please go ahead and ask your question while you're there.
Sorry, Francis. I suddenly realized I didn't quite know where these stanzas come from. Are they original writings, or did Helena Blavatsky receive them, you know, transmit them?
But your B point, and HPV received them. They were not in the lexicon of spiritual literature until The Secret Doctrine was written. So my guess is that they were revealed by the masters that worked with him, one of which was DK. And she was also provided with an old commentary, not what we read here, but an unpublished old commentary, etherically, and was able to draw on that, her understanding of the stanzas that were given. Altogether, the most extraordinary process that she underwent. She was the only one in incarnation at that time capable of doing it. And then, of course, later, Alice Bailey came along and in an entirely different style, basically gave us the next dispensation of the laws. But, you know, Treatise on Cosmic Fire is considered the successor of the Secret Doctrine, and there are a series of stanzas in the beginning, but of TCF that further describe the old commentary that began in the Secret Doctrine. Okay. So first, the previous globes disintegrate and reappear, transformed and perfected for a new phase of life. In the Kabbalah, worlds are compared to sparks which fly from under the hammer of the great architect, Law. The Law which rules all the smaller creators. So the quote, new phase of life, here described, is a new chain, which has seven new globes, onto which the life wave from the globes of the previous chain sequentially transfer. But during pralaya, both the substance and the indwelling consciousness of the new globes is, quote, transformed and perfected. Let me turn on my video. DK calls the laws here described as the law of periodicity, which he tells us in the early pages of TCF, quote, governs all manifestation, whether it is the manifestation of a solar logos through the medium of a solar system, or the manifestation of a human being through the medium of a form. This law controls likewise in all the kingdoms of nature. One of the best descriptions of the great architect comes from Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1, wherein DK states, Ray 3 constitutes the aggregate of the active building forces, and the great architect, with his builders, organizes the material, starts the work of construction, and eventually, as the evolutionary cycle proceeds upon its way, materializes the idea and purpose of God the Father under the guidance of God the Son. So both these refer to this section of the reading. Okay. The next two paragraphs reference the diagram on the next page, which has been made much more intelligible without losing any info by Project Gutenberg, the inventor and first provider of ebooks back in 1971. So we'll forego the usual format in order to keep the diagram in view as I read here, but I'm not going to read because we're pretty much at the end of our session. Any final thoughts or questions? I see a chat here. Let's see what they say. Oh, I see that was Vivian's. Yeah. So any Any final thoughts, anyone? Okay, announcements. This is the last webinar, obviously, before the conference starts in just 2 days, starts on Tuesday. So, you know, if you haven't signed up, I very strongly recommend that you do. I know that the conference organization is hurting for money. So, you know, if you can be generous with your donations, that's great. Of course, only that's not the main reason ever. We very much like to have you with us at the conference. It's a fantastic sangha that's created there. And so I hope you'll join. I'll be presenting 4 different presentations in the astrological, the rheology, and the main conference, and BL's going to be presenting as well. I know a couple in the rheology, 1 in the astrological, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And let's not forget our breakout rooms.
Yeah, and we'll be doing breakout rooms. So the idea is that we really will have a group conversation about the material as we go along. They kind of punctuate the material, you know. So we have a couple of presentations and then a breakout to discuss. So it's a great learning environment, and it's, you know, a terrific sangha, you know. It's a kind of a huge love-in with a lot of terrific material to gather around. I see Yvonne's hand.
I just want to mention that you can get in as low as $4. I mean, they'll take $4.50.
If you're broke, that's right.
If you can do it to help them, but if you can't afford anything, that you have to pay at least $4.
There you go. So, you know, panhandle, whatever it takes. But, you know, I think everybody here is, hopefully, is beyond that stage. And I would just say, you know, give what you can comfortably give, and then a little bit more. I hope to see you at the conference. If not, or in addition to, we'll be coming back online with webinars on the very last day of the conference, which is June 2nd, with the Sacred Teachings of All Ages, which is, we'll have just an hour and a half after the conference ends. Do you want to make further announcements about timing after that?
Or yeah. So the STOA on 2 June, right after the closing ceremonies. And then we have the next PCF is going to be on 14 June, and the next secret doctrine will be on 16 June. And for those of you who don't know, the Price Festival during the conference, the Gemini full moon, will be on the 23rd. The esoteric workshop is all day Friday, all day Saturday, and the morning of Sunday. And the 7-ray workshop starts the afternoon of Sunday and goes all day Monday and all day Tuesday. And the main conference begins on Wednesday, the 29th. So,
okay, you said esoteric workshop. You meant esoteric astrology workshop. So that's there's the ceremonial workshop starts on Tuesday. That's followed by astrology. That's followed by rheology. And you can find these schedules online.
Janet's got her hand raised. Go ahead, Janet. Janet?
Will part of the, let's say, I think it's 2 years on the first 3 days, or the first 20th and 21st and 22nd. On the 22nd, is he going to give the full moon before presentation, before the, like you
the,
usually
the
do?
The full moon is on the, oh, you mean the
pre-full moon.
It's not going to be, not going to happen.
One pre-one?
No, okay. I've never done a pre-full moon during a conference. Because it's taken care of by the conference program on the full moon, you know.
Okay.
Also, There's no way I would have had time.
I know.
And it's, you know, it's the full moon. It's the Festival of the Christ. It's World Invocation Day. You know, there's a lot going on that
day.
On this, you know, Christ's festival full moon. So
great. Thank you so much. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, good. And, you know, you should all get the schedule. Anybody who's, you know, planning to attend, get the schedule and, you know, look it over clearly so you'll know. I know that it starts at 7:30 a.m. on the West Coast. I believe that's right. Or is it 6:30? Maybe it's 6:30, I think, on the West Coast. So, yeah, see, I'm not even sure. I'd have to look. So it's early if you live in the U.S. Not so bad if you're on the East Coast. And much easier for those in Europe. So, and you know, it's always set that way so that the time frame can embrace as many people as possible. So that's why it starts so early on the West Coast. All right, you all, much love. Be well. We'll see you in this venue again on June 2nd. Not that far away, really. And we only had to cancel one webinar, which was the second Treatise on Cosmic Fire webinar, which is unusual. Sometimes, you know, we lose two or three. So, but not this time. So that's good. All right, you guys. See you next time.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.